Can everybody hear me okay? Is this working? All right. Okay. Well, all right. Well, I'm very honored to be here and give this talk to you. I hope you find it interesting. I'm going to be talking about some of our recent work that we've done investigating the striatum as a potential source of exaggerated beta rhythms in Parkinson's disease. So here's a brief outline of my talk. I'll start out by talking about beta rhythms and movement. And we heard a lot about that in the last talk, but I'll still go over it briefly in case some people came in late, didn't hear what was going on. But especially we're going to stick to involvement of the cortex and basal ganglia in terms of the beta rhythm. We'll talk about beta rhythm pathology in Parkinson's disease very briefly. I think a lot of you are familiar with that already. Talk about the source of the beta rhythms. There's a question mark here. Nobody really knows where they're coming from. And then I'll tell you about our thinking about the striatum as a potential source of beta rhythm generation. I'll go over some of our biophysical models of striatum, experimental tests of our models, and then talk a little bit about the mechanism of beta generation in our model networks. Okay, so let me review very briefly what was covered in a lot of detail in the last lecture. So we're talking about beta rhythms, and we're going to look at rhythms that occur in the EEG or the LFP electrodes that go between 12 and 29 hertz. It's been known for a long time that if you put an electrode over the motor cortex, you'll see this patterned change in beta rhythms as a person undergoes a voluntary movement. So here's the EMG signal. And about 1.5 seconds before movement onset, you'll see this decrease in beta, and the beta reaches a very low levels during movement, especially during the onset of movement, and then rises to higher levels than before movement, after the movement has stopped. So with this sort of relationship of beta to movement, people began to think of beta in the cortex as possibly antikinetic. Less beta makes movement more likely, more beta makes movement less likely. But it turns out that this pattern of changing beta with movement is not only a cortical phenomenon, but it can be observed throughout the cortex, basal ganglia, thalamic loop. So there have been studies, both in Parkinson's disease patients on and off medications, and other sorts of patients with epilepsy or other disorders, where you can see in cortex, striatum, STN, GPI, thalamus, that you see a very similar pattern of beta. The beta goes away prior to and during movement initiation, and then increases after movement. So this decrease in beta prior to movement and during movement is interesting in light of findings in Parkinson's disease patients. Parkinson's disease patients have this movement disorder in which they have difficulty initiating movement, slow movements, rigidity, and tremor. And many of these symptoms of Parkinson's disease are thought to be caused by loss of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra. And people have found that an increase in beta oscillations in Parkinson's disease. So I'm going to review quickly what people know about this. Parkinson's patients have increased beta oscillations in the cortex and basal ganglia. The increased beta oscillations correlate with the symptoms of bradykinesia, rigidity. L-DOPA, dopaminergic medicines, ameliorate Parkinson's symptoms and decrease the beta oscillation. And if you look at the movement cycle that I showed you in the previous few slides, patients on and off DOPA have small differences between their beta desynchronization and synchronization, so there's longer latency to the decrease in beta prior to movement if the patients are off their medications, and there's less change in beta during and after movement if the patients are off their medications. Also, deep brain stimulation at higher frequencies, so 130 or 180 hertz, alleviates Parkinson's symptoms. DBS at beta frequency can worsen symptoms, or as we heard in the last talk, possibly there's no change in symptoms, but it doesn't improve the symptoms. So our conclusion about this is that beta oscillations appear to be integral to the systems level pathology and Parkinson's disease. So these findings suggest also that beta rhythms in the cortex and the basal ganglia, or more precisely the regulation of these beta rhythms, are important to the generation of smooth, normal movements. So the question we're interested in is, how are these beta rhythms generated? What are the cellular and network components that have to interact to create these rhythms? And given that, then how are they modulated? So where does one start to look? This decrease in beta prior to and during movement, as well as the increase in beta in Parkinson's disease, appears to be present in all structures throughout the cortex and the basal ganglia. So there are a few theories about the source of the abnormal beta oscillations. It's unknown, but there's two predominating views out there about the source of beta oscillations in Parkinson's disease. One of them is that it can arise from the STN, subthalamic nucleus, globus pallidus, the external segment, this network, also called the STN-GPE pacemaker hypothesis. And this originates from experimental work that shows that the STN-GPE can oscillate independent of all other input in vitro at about 0.8 hertz. So it's not necessarily a beta frequency, it's a much lower frequency, but the thinking is that perhaps the input, in vivo there's input to the STN and GPE, such that STN and GPE might oscillate at higher frequencies in vivo. There's also very nice computational modeling that suggests that the STN and GPE network can generate rhythmic oscillations. At the parameters that were used in the model, the oscillations are not exactly at beta frequency, but I hear that the oscillations can, if you go up to beta frequency, if you change parameters in that model. So there is computational work that suggests that the STN and GPE may be able to oscillate at beta frequency. There's also thinking that beta might originate in the cortex. And there is some experimental work that shows in rat M1 brain slices, you can get a high beta that arises from co-application of carbachol and kinate. The meaning of this and its relationship to PD in vivo is a little bit unclear, though. So we decided to take another view and look at striatum. And I'm going to tell you our reasons for looking at striatum as opposed to STN-GPE or cortex. First of all, the pathophysiology of Parkinson's disease involves loss of dopaminergic neurons that project predominantly to striatum. Mm-hmm. So you would expect that the Parkinson's perturbation to this whole cortical basal ganglia thalamic system would be felt first by striatum. Also, there's been studies that show that a prominent waxing and waning beta oscillation exists in the local field potential of normal monkey striatum, there's a beta oscillation that already seems to appear in the striatum in normal monkeys. They can't test normal humans, but in normal monkeys. And importantly, in this study, in more than half of the neurons tested, their spiking was phase locked to the beta rhythm. And they also found decreased pockets of beta activity during movement. That goes along with the movement paradigms that we saw before. The striatum has a cellular and network structure to potentially support both normal and abnormal beta rhythms. So the burden of the proof is on me for this last claim, and I hope to convince you of this by the end of the talk. But I put it up there for, this is one of our reasons for thinking that the striatum is a good source for beta rhythms. So the natural question is, are beta rhythms increased in the striatum of Parkinson's disease patients? As far as I know, nobody knows. It's not a place that people put BBS electrodes. It's not usually a place that you go through when you're placing the BBS electrodes. So nobody knows, actually, in Parkinson's disease patients. Another question that you might ask is, if I can get this to work, why is the striatum ignored as a source of beta oscillations? So we found that there's a few very good reasons. The striatal network is almost entirely inhibitory. 99.7% of striatal neurons are GABAergic, and only 0.3 are cholinergic. So it's a mainly inhibitory network. Also, most of the neurons of the striatum are called these medium spiny neurons. So in the rat striatum, or in the rodent striatum, 95% of striatal neurons are just this one type, okay? Making it quite a simple structure in terms of modeling, okay? But the average spiking rate of these medium spiny neurons is 1 hertz. So that's quite a bit away from beta, right? So we have 1 hertz. Also, these MSNs, most of these neurons in the striatum, they're the only output neuron of the striatum. So if beta originates in striatum and is going to be transmitted to GPE, the downstream structures, GP, STN, and cortex, it must be expressed in these MSNs, these slow spiking cells. So it's not evident that this largely inactive and inhibitory network can generate any independent activity, much less rhythmic activity at beta or a higher frequency. But we do have mathematical models that inform us of several things. And one of those things is that we see that inhibition can create excitation under certain circumstances. And one of those circumstances is by activation of slow currents by hyperpolarization can result in rebound spiking. So here's a simple computational model of two interneurons. And one is inhibiting the other. The one that's being inhibited has one of these slow currents, and you can see that upon inhibition, it leads to a rebound spike. Okay. Whereas without inhibition, the interneuron would have remained quiescent. Okay. So some excitation has been created. And mathematical models also inform us that inhibitory networks of such neurons can produce rhythmic activity. So again, we have two interneurons, exactly the same as before, except now they're interconnected. They're quiescent without any perturbation, but if you give an external pulse of inhibition or excitation, it doesn't matter, you can start them into a network rhythm. Here we have an anti-synchronous rhythm that emerges. Okay. So we have some information from our mathematical models that tell us that inhibitory networks may be able to produce rhythmic activity. But what about beta frequency in particular? Well, the frequency of these inhibition-based rhythms depends a lot on the time constant of the slow current. And it turns out that there's one current called an M current, which is a potassium current, that has the appropriate time to rebound to support beta frequency rhythms. So here we have the same two interneurons as before, and they're interconnected by GABAergic synapses. But now these interneurons, instead of just having a generic slow current, they have an M current. Okay. And what we see is that they start out quiescent, but given some sort of pulse of excitation, or again, we could have given a pulse of inhibition, they form an anti-synchronous rhythm. But now the anti-synchronous rhythm is at 20 hertz, so we're right in the beta frequency range. Okay. So it seems, so how does this then relate to striatal dynamics? Well, it turns out that the MSNs, so that the major component of the striatum, 95% of the cells of the striatum, have an M current. And these MSNs are also interconnected by GABA-A synapses, okay? So it's a much more extensive network of this simple two-cell network. It indicates that beta rhythm generation may be possible in striatum. Okay. It seems that striatum has some of the characteristics in that make it particularly prone to producing beta rhythms. However, it's still far from clear whether a larger striatal model of interconnected MSNs can produce beta. We definitely need more than two cells. We also need the MSNs spiking at a much lower rate, right? They have an average rate of 1 hertz, not of 10 hertz each. And also the GABA-A conductance from one MSN to another is extremely small. We also need a lot of noise. The striatum is getting excitatory input from cortex and thalamus, inhibitory input from interneurons, so we need a lot of noise in our models as well. I'm going to say right now, in our models of striatum, we're not going to use other striatal interneurons. And I'm going to explain why later, because it'll be clear later in the talk why we're not going to use them. However, we also want to remember, though, that the MSNs are the only output neuron of the striatum. So if beta is expressed in these MSNs, then it could be transmitted to downstream structures. And if it can be expressed in a network of MSNs only, then that's great, because that's the minimal network that we need for downstream transmission. So let me tell you about our model MSNs and their networks. Okay, so here's our biophysical model of striatum. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this, because I assume a lot of you are already very quite familiar with this type of modeling, or if you're not, you're not interested in hearing about it at this point in time. I'll just go over this very briefly, but we use biophysical models of neurons to run our experiments. And we describe each neuron by a set of equations that describes the flow of the transmembrane currents and the resultant change in the voltage over time. We use single compartment models for our MSNs. Ionic currents are described using Ohm's law with Hodge and Huxley type conductances. And here are the Hodge and Huxley type gating variables that are dependent on time and voltage in general. Okay. For our MSNs, the only currents we're using, we have a very minimal model. We're only using spiking currents, sodium, potassium, and leak, to be able to get to model the spike. We have the M current, because we think that's going to be important. Background excitation and noise, a lot of noise. Okay. These neurons are not isolated, so we place them in networks. The only synaptic current between these is a GABA-A current, which is very, very weak. Nobody knows exactly how this network is connected, so we look at several topologies and several different sizes of networks, 100 MSNs and 400 MSNs. We look at all 30 nearest neighbors, 30% random, 30% random here, and this is our most stringent condition, the 7.5% random connections in our 400 network model. And we also, for our model output, what we're looking for is the spiking of individual medium spiny neurons, and then we have a model of our LFP, since this is what people tend to measure experimentally. And our model of LFP is created by just summing the synaptic currents throughout the entire network. So it's important to note that we're using biophysical models. And we use these models because we're interested in determining exactly how the currents interact in the models to produce the spiking and the potentially rhythmic activity that might result, which turns out to actually play an important role in our model results. So after running the simulations and showing you how the model behaves, we'll come back and look at the original equations to see what are the important components of generating the behavior we observe. Okay, so let me show you how our model behaves, our striatal model, under normal conditions. Okay, so here's our normal striatum. This is a raster plot. We have 100 MSNs here. Here's time. And you can see that the average MSN spiking rate, first of all, is 1 hertz, so we've been able to reproduce that. You can also see that there's no obvious patterned activity in this model striatum. However, if you look at our LFP, our model LFP, you actually do see a peak in the power at a beta frequency range, in a low beta range, okay? Which might seem a little surprising if you're just looking at the raster plot, but it's not completely surprising, because we know we have the right currents in there, right, to create beta rhythms. We saw that in the smaller cell models with two cells, we could create very robust beta rhythms. Okay, so we can see that those currents are at work in the population activity of this normal striatum. Okay. Furthermore, if we look at the beta power over time in a spectrogram of our models, you can see a waxing and waning of the beta. So it kind of comes in and out of existence there. Which is similar to what was observed experimentally in the normal monkey striatum. Mm-hmm. So So we think we have a nice model of normal striatum that accounts for some of the experimentally observed dynamics of both individual neurons in the striatum and networks of neurons within the striatum. Next, we want to look at then how does network behave under Parkinsonian conditions. So what are those conditions? Well, the striatum has many neuromodulators. We're going to focus on dopamine and acetylcholine. Dopamine because that's what's lost in Parkinson's disease. But why acetylcholine? Well, there's been a lot of work showing that there's interactions between dopamine and acetylcholine in the striatum. And it's actually the balance of acetylcholine and dopamine that's critical for regulating the activity of the medium spiny neurons. In fact, up until the 1960s, the only pharmacologic therapy for Parkinson's disease were anticholinergics before L-DOPA came on the market. So it makes sense, and it's been shown that dopamine tonically inhibits acetylcholine release in the striatum. If you decrease dopamine, which is what you see in Parkinson's disease, you'll see an increase in acetylcholine. The M current in the MSNs is reduced by acetylcholine. Okay, this has been shown experimentally. Reduction of the M current produces excitation. So in our model Parkinsonian networks, instead of going through a whole cascade of what dopamine does to an MSN, we're going to model the Parkinsonian MSN network by decreasing the M current maximal conductance, okay, simulating that increase in acetylcholine. So I'm going to note right now that one reason for not including the fast spiking neurons in our model in the striatum is that acetylcholine attenuates the FS inhibition of the MSNs. So if acetylcholine is increased in the striatum in Parkinson's disease, we assume that the the fast spiking neurons are not interacting very much with the MSNs. And since it's the Parkinsonian striatum that we're most interested in modeling, we don't include FS neurons in our model. Okay. So what happens to our models when we simulate the Parkinsonian state in this manner? Okay. Well, you can see, so this is the same network, exactly the same network as before. We have the 100 MSNs and over time. But now you see there's an obvious patterning of the MSNs, whereas we didn't see any patterning before. The average spiking rate is slightly higher. It's 4 hertz now. And if we look at our model LFP, here the blue line is before the normal striatum, and the green line is after. You can see that the beta power has gone up, and that it's the actual frequency of the beta power has increased. Okay, before it was 12 hertz, now we're up to 17 hertz. Also, if we look at the spectrogram, we see a much more persistent beta oscillation than in the normal network. So we lose much of that waxing and waning that we saw in our normal model striatum. So the model predicts a higher beta power in PD. And more importantly, it predicts that the higher beta power is related to patterning of these MSNs on a population level, that's actually what's responsible for the increase in beta. It also predicts an increased average spiking rate and an increased frequency of the power of beta. We've been able to find some evidence for these changes in the literature. So there's some studies that show that there's some evidence that MSN spiking rate is increased in Parkinsonian animal models of, so in the 6-OHD rat. This is an anesthetized rat, but you can see only one spike in the normal rat, and then quite a bit of spiking of the MSNs in the 6-OHD rat. In the MPTP monkey, again, we see increased spiking of MSNs. These are, 28, it's not the frequency that we're seeing, but we see increased spiking. And to be fair, I have seen studies, too, that say the spiking is decreased. So I think that this is open to debate. Does spiking go up or down? Our model predicts it goes up. What about that frequency shift, which I think is quite interesting? Well, there is a recent study that's come out that shows that the power and the frequency of cortical of cortical beta is higher in PD than in essential tremor. So this is a very recent article that showed that there's essential tremor. It's comparing patients with essential tremor, dystonia, and Parkinson's disease. Essential tremor we're taking as sort of control. Essential tremor isn't thought to have basal ganglia involvement like PD does. So we think of essential tremor as a control. It seems that cortical beta is usually at a little bit lower frequency than what you'd see in PD. I don't know much about dystonia, so I'm not going to talk about that. Let's see. What else about our models? Our models seem to be quite robust. They're largely invariant to network connectivity, to network size, and to heterogeneity. So the top row is all the 100 network models, and these are the 400 network models. And in each case, whether we connect them all to all nearest neighbors, random, different percents of random connectivity, and the different sizes, you see that the normal striatum has a low beta peak, and the Parkinsonian striatum has this higher power of beta and higher frequency of beta in each case. Okay. So we have a robust model that satisfies some of the key features that we wanted to reproduce in our model of normal and Parkinsonian striatal dynamics. So we proceed to test this model experimentally then. And since the model predicts that beta should arise from an MSN network in the presence of high cholinergic tone, and should actually somewhat isolate the MSN network in some ways because we're stopping the FS, the fast spiking interneurons, from having so much influence over the MSNs, we tested the model by infusing the cholinergic agonist carbachol into the striatum of normal, awake, behaving mice. So let me just orient you. So this is the striatal LFP prior to carbachol infusion. Here's the spectrogram. Here's the actual trace of the LFP. You can see not much. I mean, if anything, there's a lot of low frequency activity, possibly a little beta. I don't know. But what's important is that after we infuse carbachol into the striatum, we saw, first of all, so this is the LFP trace. Again, this is a spectrogram. Right here where you see spikes, the mouse had a tremor, so it induced some sort of tremor-like oscillations. But you can see between the tremor movements is this beautiful beta oscillation. Okay, it's so nice that you can even count the oscillations. You don't need the spectrogram. This is a beautiful beta oscillation. So we considered this a successful test of our model. And interestingly, both the prominent beta and the tremor oscillation subsided after the carbachol wore off. And you have a perfectly normal mouse again in about 10 minutes. Some controls that we looked at. In particular, we looked at beta oscillations are not due to pressure on the striatum, due to infusion. We were told that this was an important control to do. So you can see there's a concentration dependence also. We tested different concentrations of carbachol. It was only with a certain lower concentrations didn't do anything, but a little bit higher concentration, we got the beta upon infusion of the carbachol. And we were also worried that maybe the carbachol was diffusing to the nearby cortex. So we tested the cortical LFP with cortical carbachol infusion, and nothing happened. And when we did cortical carbachol infusion, nothing happened in the striatum either. So the second experiment also speaks against the theory that just increasing gain anywhere in the cortical basal ganglia thalamic loop is enough to create beta within that loop. So we used biophysical models for a purpose. So that we could examine a little bit more carefully the dynamics at work on the cellular level that enable the network to produce beta oscillations at the population level. And we find that a pair of currents is important in the generation of beta in our MSN network, as suggested by our two-cell model, and that is the GABA-A and the M current. So let me just run through briefly If you're not familiar with the M current, some of its essential properties. So again, it has this Hodgson-Huxley type activation gate. It's a non-inactivating potassium current, so it doesn't have an inactivation gate. It only has one activation gate. And it's also has a slow and voltage dependent time constant of decay. So this light blue line here is the time constant of decay of the M current. This is the time constant of decay of all the other currents in our model. So you can see this is much larger. And these properties allow the M current to, one, be active at resting membrane potentials, and to influence the membrane voltage between spikes. And because the M current is a potassium current, like I mentioned before, potassium currents hyperpolarize the membrane. They make it harder to generate a spike. So what happens to the M current during the interspike interval after GABA-A inhibition? What happens and how does that affect the behavior of the cell? Well, it turns out that the M current conductance is reduced by the GABA-A current. So here we have two GABA-A conductances, and you can see what the M current conductance response is to the GABA-A current, that it's decreased. Okay. So remember, a decrease in the M current is going to lead to more excitability in the cell. So GABA-A reduces the M current, and increasing GABA-A conductance will increase the M current reduction. M current reduction continues after GABA-A has decayed back to baseline, because the M current is much slower. The time constant of decay is much slower with the M current than it is with the GABA-A current. So this reduction of the M current continues during the interspike interval, and that creates increased membrane excitability. Okay, so increasing the GABA-A maximal conductance, what things can cause that? Well, I mean, there's definitely things like anesthetics and sedatives that can increase GABA-A conductance pharmacologically, but also just increasing coincident spiking will increase GABA-A conductance. Okay, so remember, our GABA-A conductance is very low in our MSN model. It's a very small GABA-A conductance. But if two or more MSNs synapse coincidentally on another MSN, the GABA-A conductance will be higher. Okay. I guess I should mention that we've done a much more formal mathematical analysis of the interaction between these two currents, which is beyond the scope of what we're talking about now. It involves, you know, geometry of critical manifolds and folded saddles. But if you are interested in hearing more about this, I've heard that in the last series of talks in this forum on anesthesia, that Martin Weschelberger will be talking about that interaction. So we're not going to get too much into it right now. But what I do want to say is that the beta tends to be enhanced by any mechanism that increases the interaction between these two currents. So what will increase those interactions? Well, if you can increase the MSN spiking rate, or if you can increase the GABA-A conductance, any of this will help to increase the beta rhythm. So these are spectrograms of our computational models. I'll take this first, increasing the applied current. Here's the spiking rate of the neurons. You see, as you increase the applied current, the spiking rate goes up, but also both the power and the frequency of the beta oscillation tends to go up. You can also increase the MSN spiking rate by decreasing the M current conductance, which is what I showed you in our models before. So decreasing the M current conductance increases the spiking rate. And as we increase the spiking rate, a beta rhythm emerges and increases in both power and frequency. Another way to increase the interaction between these two currents is just to increase the GABA-A conductance. Right. So in our models, we can just increase the GABA-A conductance. As we increase it, it's not as dramatic, but you can see that there is a rise in both beta power and beta frequency. And it's not as dramatic, but it's quite paradoxical, because you wouldn't think that increasing an inhibitory conductance would help you to achieve higher frequencies in the network, but it seems to. And you can see here that increasing the GABA-A conductance isn't necessarily associated with an increase in firing rate. that it goes down to begin with and then comes back up. So I did a quick literature search to see, you know, what sort of modulators of these different components might be. And you can see that the M current has quite a few modulators. The applied current would be input from the cortex and thalamus, GABA A neurosteroids or sedatives or anesthetics. And so all of these could potentially be tests of our model. But of course, we think that the acetylcholine was the best test because we isolated the MSN network, whereas tests like with sedatives and anesthetics, I think we probably are potentiating the SS cells in the models in the striatum as well, and we could be shutting down the network. So I think those tests would require a more extensive model of striatum. So our next step that we're just beginning to look at is propagation of beta rhythms to GPE and STN. Okay, so taking our striatal model that we have of beta rhythm production, we want to know under normal and Parkinsonian conditions in the globus pallidus and the STN. Here's our STN neurons, globus pallidus, STN and globus pallidus neurons. Can the striatally generated beta propagate into different structures? So we've just begun these experiments, and we're finding that we can get normal sort of unsynchronized spiking in the GPE and STN in normal state. It becomes replaced by more bursty and synchronized spiking in the STN and GP in the Parkinsonian states. Again, and here the synchrony is at beta as well. So that the GPE and the STN neurons seem to be following the beta that's coming from striatum. We do need one additional perturbation to get this dynamic to happen, and we need to increase the conductance between the GPE and the STN neurons. And there is evidence exists for this increased conductance in low dopamine state. The transmission from striatum to STN, we think, depends on also this increased conduction between GPE and STN. However, transmission of striatal beta only to GPE seems to be independent of any other parameter change in our model. So that's what we're finding there. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so here's summary and conclusions. So what have I talked about? I told you the modulation of beta rhythms throughout the cortical basal ganglia thalamic loop seems to be important in smooth coordinated movements. Beta rhythms are exaggerated in Parkinson's disease in both the cortex and basal ganglia. I hope I've convinced you that the striatum appears to have both the cellular network mechanisms sufficient to produce robust beta oscillations in MSN network models. Model MSN networks show increased beta oscillations under Parkinsonian conditions. Experimental testing of the MSN network by infusion of carbachol into the mouse striatum produced robust beta oscillations. And it seems that the interaction between the GABA-A and the M current is critical to the creation of beta in the model MSN network. And I'd like to give thanks to Nancy, who has supported me through all of this. Xuer Han did all the experimental work on infusing carbachol into the striatum of mice. Tyler and Carolyn are graduate students working with Xuer on the striatum. Ori, Ming, and Sri and I are on with Nancy are in an ongoing collaboration. We've had many discussions about beta and STN and GPE and striatum. Emery Brown over at MIT, some of the foundational ideas for this work came from work that I did with Emery, and Ed Boyden was instrumental in helping with some of the experimental design. And thank you.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I think it's great. groundbreaking, you know, sort of like, you know, out of the box thinking.
Thank you.
So I just want to kind of get my head around this a little bit and try and understand, you know, sort of the cascade of events. So can you kind of, you know, go through it one more time? You've got, you know, sort of, you have this medium strike, this MSN, and it's getting, it has this M current in it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you're saying that acetylcholine exacerbates the ability of the MSN to then generate.
Yeah, so acetylcholine, we think what it really does is just increase the spiking rate of the neurons. That's
okay.
How it's helping.
Okay.
So increasing the spiking rate is going to help increase the probability that you'll have coincident GABA A synapses, right? That MSNs might synapse more coincidentally onto, say, a certain MSN.
Yes.
Increasing the GABA A conductance, which will decrease the M current conductance, giving more excitation to the postsynaptic cell, making it rebound spike. And the time to rebound spike then is, it really depends on both the GABA A and the M current conductance. But the time to rebound spike in the system is such that it will be at beta. Okay. So you start getting this patterned form then, where it's in some ways like a positive feedback, right? That you get more cells spike, you get increased GABA A, decreased M current, another cell participates in the beta rhythm, which will then synapse onto other MSNs, and then, you know,
yeah.
I'm going to hand wave at this point because I'm not sure about how patterns are actually generated after that, but those are foundational steps to creating the beta rhythm.
So how does that, you know, how does the story evolve in relation to the interaction between the loss of dopamine and essentially the gain of acetylcholine?
Yeah, so the other thing is, so dopamine, when you decrease dopamine, there's a lot of studies that show that you'll get more excitation of MSNs in the indirect pathway and less excitation of MSNs in the direct pathway. So our model actually predicts that because of the increased MSN excitation in the indirect pathway, that that's where the beta is going to exist. The MSNs of these two pathways are quite isolated. There's not much overlap between these pathways. So you can think of them as almost two networks, two MSN networks. Okay. One increases its spiking and one decreases its spiking in response to dopamine. So we could look at that as well, right? We could, and people have. I mean, people have actually looked at decrease in dopamine. There's a lot of studies where you decrease dopamine and you will see beta go up in the striatum. Okay, but we wanted to, in order to test our model, we wanted to test it in a way that, well, first of all, hasn't been shown before. Something that actually tests the model. Like I said, it was a nice experimental test because it isolated the MSN network in a way that I think that putting on dopamine or increasing GABA A conductance or some of these other things would involve other interneurons in the striatum and would be harder to test.
What I wanted to kind of point out slash question is that this all depends on the assumption of your training neural model.
Mm-hmm.
And the model is basically just a function of the current events and outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that there are probably other current
yes.
time courses that would be added together the aggregate sort of networks might change or
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My question is first, why did you, or how did you initially pick that and kind of just look at all the
uh-huh.
sort of saw the application from there?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's the time for data.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, have you been thinking about the other current?
Mm-hmm. So, Well, first of all, let me address about the other currents. So we've looked at some of the other currents. There are a lot of currents in the MSN cells. We've looked at some of the other currents, and they don't seem to have the appropriate time to rebound to generate beta rhythms. So we didn't put them in the model. Obviously, it's a model, so you know we can't put everything in the model. We want to put in what are the fundamental or critical interactions that can create the beta rhythm, right? We haven't made more complex models with multiple compartments and different currents. No, we haven't tested that. And it would be interesting to see, you know, if this model could hold up under those conditions as well. But we haven't done that. Okay. But we do think that still that the GABA AM current interaction is you know critical. And is it? I mean, even if we put more of these details into the model. We don't know in MSNs, I mean, is there localization of the M current to the GABA A synapses or things like this to make it more, you know, more likely that this interaction will take place and be influential in cell dynamics and network dynamics, right? There's just a lot unknown about the MSNs and the current interactions. Okay. This is definitely a first step, though, right? Definitely a first step. But we think we did, I mean, we think we've isolated some of the minimal interactions that you need to create a beta rhythm. Where did this originate? It originated with work that I started with Emory Brown and Nancy Coppell. We were working on anesthetics. Anesthetics increase GABA-A conductance. And we initially were looking at how anesthetics can create a state of paradoxical excitation, which also involves an increase in beta rhythms. So there was a natural transition from the anesthetic-induced beta to the Parkinson's-induced beta.
The specificity that you just mentioned is that I kind of missed on the direct-indirect pathway. Is that something to do with this D2?
D1, D2. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought about that.
You didn't have
it
on your list.
No, I did not have that on my list. I don't know what would happen. So that would, I don't know. I'd have to think about it before. Hard to think when you're up here. I have to think about it more, how that would affect, yeah. How that would affect the different currents, yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Thank you.